Attention all civilians.
You're listening to TalkZone.com. Internet Talk Radio. TalkZone.com. Now, the Dave Baum Show on TalkZone.com. Internet Talk Radio. Here's your host, Dave Baum.
Welcome to the Dave Baum Show on TalkZone.com. Nice to have you aboard. We got a great show for you today. And I think everybody can be interested because it has to do with what you put in your car. Head to that filling station, regardless of where you live. It's going to cost you, my guess is somewhere in the upper threes if the magic number hasn't turned to four already. And that's interesting, too, because the older pumps at these filling stations were never calibrated to go beyond $399.9. So a lot of them are being reformulated these days to new numbers, magic numbers like four, and who knows, maybe five, maybe six, maybe seven. So the question on your mind really is, based on the economy, gasoline, energy, price of oil, where do we get more? And this goes way, way back, friends. I'm old enough to remember when gas went from 19.9 to 75 cents a gallon in 1973. And people waited for 45 minutes in line to get 6 gallons of gas. They were angry then. And there were all kinds of accusations of about where we get our oil and can't we be self-sufficient. Well, maybe the answer to that is yes. And a portion of today's Dave Baum Show on TalkZone.com will be spent looking at the pros and cons of exploring in the Arctic. Then something that hits close to home to me. If you have a love of any sport, either as a participant or as an observer, you had to have noticed over the years the amount of acceptable, what I call AC, the amount of acceptable cheating that's been going on from the grade school level to the high school level to the college level to the pro level. Some people call it gamesmanship. I call it cheating in sports. And having spent a great portion of my professional life in covering sports and doing sports, I can see some of the subtle differences in gamesmanship and cheating and why it's occurring. So today we're going to talk about energy, oil, Arctic, and then later, cheating in sports, all part of the Dave Baum Show. Compelling talk radio right here on TalkZone.com. Here are the incidentals. You want to give us a call? 1-888-463-6748. It's toll-free. And we appreciate the number of calls we've been getting because of the popularity of this show that's extended beyond 115 countries and thousands of cities. Thank you very much. That's 1-888-463-6748. If you're overseas and want to call us, very simple, 011, make a note of that, 011, then 847-470-0937, 847-470-0937. Energy, energy, energy. Oil from abroad is skyrocketing, and so is the price at the pump. How can we become less dependent on our so-called friends over there and more dependent on resources over here? Well, in the 70s, oil companies promoted then-shelved plans to extract oil from shale. And if you're listening in Colorado and parts of Colorado to this show as I speak, and you live in and around towns with the cute names of Parachute and Rifle, you'll remember those short-lived halcyon days of the 70s when the oil companies came knocking and said, we want to extract oil from shale. That didn't last long. Why? Because the oil companies couldn't make any money. A mantra that a friend once told me to follow in all major developments of our lives, follow the money. So the oil companies couldn't make money from extracting oil from shale then. They shelved the project. The juicy American prize today is called the 1002 area. That's 1002 area. Mark it down. You'll hear more about it. 1.5 million acres of untouched God's country called the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. Here's what we're talking about. The last great wilderness. more than 19 million acres in all, 8 million acres designated wilderness, 45 species of land and marine mammals, 180-plus species of birds, 36 species of fish. Simply stated, large-scale ecological and evolutionary processes free, I underline free, of human control or manipulation, an unbroken continuum of Arctic and subarctic ecosystems, which have been inhabited for centuries, as you probably remember from schoolwork, by Eskimos and Indians, the Inupiat Eskimos and the Gwich'in Indians. There are no roads. There is very limited access, very remote. In their words, and I'm quoting them here, here where the wild has not been taken out of the wilderness, period, close quotes. Certainly not a tourist trap. It's managed by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. There are no Anwar trail maps pointing the way if you want to hike. And hikers, explorers are totally on their own, unless you want to hire a very expensive guide to fly in. In 1980, Congress mandated studies of the petroleum and biological resources of the 1002 area. Since then, numerous efforts to open 1002 for petroleum exploration have been beaten back by what I'll call the Leave the Place Alone coalitions. Today, we'll look at the pros and cons of opening up Area 1002 for exploration and development. It is said by some that there may be, well, I'll let our guests talk about what may be there. Our first guest on the Dave Baum Show is Adrian Herrera, spokesperson for Arctic Power, an Anchorage, Alaska-based nonprofit organization that lobbies for oil drilling in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. The state of Alaska provides the majority of Arctic Power's money. Adrian, welcome to the Dave Baum Show. Nice to have you with us today.
Thanks, Dave. I appreciate you having me on.
From the beginning of this debate, and it really goes back, I think, to, to what happened in 1973 and 74, so we're saying 30-plus years about do we explore, do we not explore. Are you seeing signs as an advocate that pressure is relenting a little bit to allow maybe not all, but some exploration?
Yeah, absolutely. It all has to do with public pressure on Congress, really. This is a problem that Congress created, and Congress needs to solve it. I suppose, along with your comment about 1973 and oil crisis back then, you can look at modern times and Hurricane Katrina, not a few years ago. You know, the week after Hurricane Katrina hit, you had sort of disruptions in supply to refineries and output from refineries in the Gulf of Mexico area. And immediately you had voices in Congress saying, guess what, folks, we have to look at domestic production. People who were adamantly opposed to opening up the coastal plain of Anwar suddenly changed their position overnight, simply because they knew that their electorate, their constituents, weren't going to have anything of it and were not willing to pay high prices for gasoline and fuel products.
Well, we're at a point now where depending upon on who you read, Adrian, you get different estimates of what is there. The American Petroleum Institute, better known as the API, says, from what I saw, somewhere between 10 to 15 billion barrels, perhaps as much as 30 to 35 years worth of Middle East oil imports.
Yeah,
is that the number you're using, or do you say it's less or more?
Well, the official figures, and we can only use official figures, come from the United States Geological Survey, which in 1998 was commissioned by Congress to do a study of the what's called, not rather 1002 area, but 1002 area, the coastal plain area of Anwar, which is the only area of Anwar under debate, by the way. The rest of Anwar is completely closed forever, permanently. At any rate, their figures, the USGS figures in 1998, were based on a technical recovery rate of 37%. That means that when an oil company drills a well in a puddle of oil underground, they can estimate in 1998 get 37% of that oil out of the ground successfully. The rest is impossible to recover because they didn't have the technology.
Mm-hmm.
To, you know, those big,
10 years later.
Yeah, 10 years later, the average, you know, well produces 60 to 65% of what it goes for. So essentially, the recovery rate is doubled. At any rate, using the official figures from the USGS, they estimated in-place resources. So that means what they thought was underground is a 95% probability that there's 16 billion barrels of oil. Okay, that's their official figure. You can read it on their website, on the internet. And a 5% probability that there's 42 billion barrels of oil there. So that's in-place reserve. That means total. Regardless of the ability to get it out of the ground or the price of oil, that's how much they thought was there. And again, any geologist will tell you, nobody on God's green earth knows how much oil is underground in Anwar until wells are drilled. It's a guess. It's an educated, scientific, geologic guess, but it is nonetheless a guess. So the USGS said, okay, well, we know there's between 16 billion barrels and 42 billion barrels at a high end in the ground. Using 37% recovery rate, which was the norm at the time, 10 years ago, they said their figures were 5.7 billion barrels of oil at a low-end estimate and 16 billion barrels at a high-end estimate,
mm-hmm.
with the middle of the range at 10.3. So, you know, we give these figures out, but the figures are dated. I mean, it's almost irrelevant, really, because, you know, modern technology is so much better than it was in the past. And the report was using information that was generated in 1983, for goodness sakes. I mean, you know, it's like the difference between a black and white television of the past and a color television. What we know,
or today, color TV and high def, really.
Right, exactly. I mean, the technology that we have today to just figure out how much is there is so much better than what we had 10, 20 years ago. So the report figures are, in my mind, statistics and statistics only. They're best guessed estimates, but they're estimates that have caveats to them, i.e. 37% recovery rate.
Adrian Herrera, our guest. We're talking about the pros and cons of exploring 1.5 million acres. Now, as Adrian pointed out, there's more than 19 million acres in all, but we're talking about this area 1002, 1.5 million acres, based upon the last research, as he pointed out, in 1998. So much, 10 years later, the amount may remain the same, but the recovery probably has increased because of technology. If we use the number hypothetically, Adrian,
yeah.
20 billion barrels.
Right.
Let's just say 20 billion barrels.
Sure.
How much, once that's refined, how much energy will that provide for Americans at the pump?
Well, a barrel of oil produces actually more refined product than it physically is initially, and that's because in the refining process, it's thinned out. And so oil is very viscous. It's very, it's not very fluid, very sticky. And when you refine it, you thin it out to produce things like gasoline, kerosene, jet fuel, things like that. So you get actually almost double the product out of a single barrel of oil. Okay? So you're getting actually more gasoline than the actual oil physically is to begin with.
Right. But in terms of Americans at the pump, because obviously, everybody asks the same question, what's in it for me?
Right.
So if we're talking about 20 billion,
mm-hmm.
and that may be a conservative estimate, 20 billion barrels, which is then refined into
double that
formulated gas, diesel, et cetera,
right.
What is that going to mean to Americans at the pump over what period of time?
Very good question. And the answer is not terribly sexy in that, It's exactly as you said, over a period of time. I mean, oil just doesn't flow onto the market at full force. It ramps up gradually, it peaks, and then it slowly declines over a period of probably 50 or so years. Gradually, if you opened up the 1002 area of Anwar, you'd have an increase into the domestic production of oil for America. Every barrel of oil that you produce at home replaces one that you have to buy from abroad. Now, tag into this whole equation, to make it even more complicated, is the fact that demand year by year is increasing, not decreasing. So we're actually buying more and more and more every single year, not less and less and less. So, you know, the impact of what this will have at prices at the pump is hugely speculative. you know, you can't.
Well, that's nothing new, because some would contend that part of the problem today is the speculative work by commodities people,
exactly,
and others dealing in oil futures.
Exactly right. I mean, it is a stock market of commodities, and that stock market fluctuates in price by people's impression of what the demand will be in a month or 2 months' time.
Well, I'm sure that one of the questions you get as a lobbyist by a senator other than in the state of Alaska, maybe it's a senator from a land-bound state like Illinois or maybe Kansas, is the question that I just alluded to a moment ago. How much oil can be taken out of there and formulated into gasoline, and how long will that gasoline last us as Americans? Do you have any idea?
Well, I'll tell you one thing. I don't think there is any figure that anybody has ever figured out for the answer of that. The one figure that one can tell you is that it will last over 30 years. The benefit of this activity will be over 30 years' time.
So that's 30 years we wouldn't need Arab oil to the degree that we're taking it now.
Yeah, the figure is it will replace outright, completely.
Oh, totally replace.
Yeah, 100% of Saudi Arabian oil for 30 years. That is the actual physical amount of oil that we can get out of the ground up there. So 30 years without Saudi Arabia for free.
Now, the other question, and by the way, let me remind you that if you want in on this conversation, as we talk about the pros and cons of exploring in ANWR, Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, 1-888-463-6748. Adrian Herrera with us, a spokesman for Arctic Power, a nonprofit organization that is lobbying for oil drilling in the Arctic. It's one thing to say how much oil is there, and as you say, the amount is generally known. The other side of the coin is here we are at a date certain which you and I are talking. If we started today, let's say ABC Oil Corporation got a small portion of the rights to start drilling tomorrow.
Mm-hmm.
How long would it take that oil company and its operation to begin, literally to begin to extract the first barrel of oil?
Between 5 to 6 years is a realistic logistical probability. I mean, that is a truly realistic figure. They estimate that full production will be reached in 10 years. So in 5 to 6 years, you will have oil flowing down the Trans-Alaska pipeline from the 1002 area.
Where would it be refined, in as much as we haven't built any new refineries?
Yeah, all the oil in Alaska goes to the east coast of America. The west coast of America. It goes to Puget Sound.
Okay.
Refineries in Puget Sound. It goes to refineries just to the south of Los Angeles.
Would we have to build new refineries? And what I was alluding to is we ain't built any since the late 60s, early 70s.
Yeah. The answer to that is, in the long term, yes, but not as a direct result of ANWR oil. No, because ANWR oil can be handled by the capacity of refineries that currently exist. As our demand for oil increases, yes, we will have to build new refineries.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Eskimos and Indians, separate and distinct in the Arctic, in northern Alaska.
Right.
The Eskimos say yes, don't they?
Yes. The natives, the Eskimos of Kaktovik and the North Slope of Alaska, who own private lands within the 1002 area, really desperately want this to happen.
Why?
The reason is because to them this is an issue of human rights. This is an issue of, hey, American people took our land. It was our land for 40,000 years. And in 1971, the Congress passed a bill called ANSCA, Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act. And this was essentially to give the natives of Alaska, all of the natives and Indians of Alaska, compensation for the land that the American Western government had taken from them, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And ANSCA gave the people of the North Slope of Alaska land within what is now the 1002 area. They own 92,000 acres of private land. That's private property. They have the title deed for it. And now, because of the ANILCA bill in 1980 that expanded the borders of ANWR around this land, they can't do a thing about it. Now, the thing is that there are no jobs up in the Arctic. There's no McDonald's, there's no Safeway, there's no shops to go and apply for a job, there's no businesses whatsoever. The way these people get their money to survive on a daily basis is through what are native corporations set up during the 1971 ANSCA bill. And these native corporations make every man, woman, and child in the Arctic a shareholder, and they collectively and socially distribute dividend funds to these native peoples, the members of their all the societies up there, so that they can survive. Where did the funds come from? They come from the royalties and taxes levied on the oil industry for drilling and operation on native private lands. So that the reason the natives are for this is because if they allow oil exploration on native lands in the 1002 area,
they'll do well.
They'll do well.
Oh, yeah.
Exactly. But the thing is that people say, oh, well, it's just a bunch of people trying to get rich in the Arctic. Nonsense. There are no jobs up there. There's no job to give you a salary. This is their entire existence. Without this money, they will disappear into the Stone Age.
Let me ask you, though, Adrian, about the other side of this issue to me, which is the social impact side of the issue.
Mm-hmm.
If there is exploration,
yeah.
Doing some reading on my own, I came to the understanding that most of these native villages in northern Alaska ban alcohol by law.
Right.
If there is an opening of this acreage for exploration, what's going to be, in your opinion, the social impact of all of the busyness, commercialism?
Well, I think, 35 years of history with Prudhoe Bay, which is only 45 miles away from the 1002 area. Prudhoe Bay is the largest oil field in the entire North American continent and one of the largest in the entire world. The natives own corporations that are used for oil field services. For example, drilling contractors, wire liners, catering staff, security staff, wildlife monitoring staff, and they are hired by their own corporations and by other outside independent corporations, oil field supplying contract organizations, to work in the oil field. So now that they have a job, they have an income, they can bring home money and live like you and I do every day.
So you're suggesting there wouldn't be much negative social impact on opening this up?
No, absolutely not. It's 100% benefit.
Mm-hmm.
You mentioned alcoholism and things like that.
Well, it's
this
a concern
that is not caused by the oil industry. I don't know if you're suggesting that. I don't think you are.
No, what I'm suggesting is that history has taught us a number of things, and one of them is that when you open up a portion of the land, which is the American West, for example, or other areas for exploration, a lot of things begin to happen very quickly, and just basically deluge an area with social impact it was never used to.
Yes. But
can't deny that.
Yeah, I think over the last 35 years, the Alaskan Native community as a whole has done an absolutely superb job of managing themselves and bringing themselves very, very responsibly into the 21st century. They've done more, with their societies than we have with ours in the last 200 years, and they've accomplished the same in 40 years' time.
Adrian, what is the sensitive way today, based on a greater degree of technology than the last geological study you said in 1998,
mm-hmm.
What is the sensitive way today to drill in this wilderness?
Well, what is proposed, there's a good example of that, and that's called the Alpine Oil Field, which is to the west of Prudhoe Bay, currently existing. And what is proposed is gravel island pads. They build a gravel pad about 10 feet off the tundra, all solid gravel, and they use these pads to operate from. There are no roads in between pads. It's just like an island, except it's on land. It's not at sea. This is the sort of scenario that is portrayed as what will possibly exist in the 1002 area of Anwar if exploration is allowed. All of the support facilities, i.e. power generation, water desalinization, oil and gas, and water separation plants, already exist in Prudhoe Bay. None of that needs to be built. It's already working and existing 45 miles away. So what you're essentially looking at is an island pad with well houses on it. Those well houses are 10 foot by 10 foot by 10 foot square, and they sit on top of a wellhead. A drilling rig, which is brought in during the wintertime, because activity is only allowed in the wintertime in Alaska, is used to drill those wells. When the well is drilled, it's capped, the drilling rig goes away, and all you're left with is this little tiny box. So these are the, if you can imagine that, a 4 or 5 acre pad with 10 or 20 wellheads on it, and a feeder pipeline heading west towards Prudhoe Bay. That's about it. None of the industrial complex that, you know, was constructed in the 70s in Prudhoe Bay is necessary. It simply exists already. Why build it twice?
How can the oil company suggest that if tundra is destroyed for one reason or another, obviously nature doesn't recapture tundra. So what do the oil companies say to those who would suggest that with a tremendous number, I would guess, of cats and vehicles like that going across the tundra, that there will be some tundra environmentally destroyed?
I think that's 100% false. I think zero tundra, not one acre of it, will be destroyed. A very good example of this is what's called the KIC well, which is KIC. It stands for Kaktovik Inupiaq Corporation, which is the only well ever drilled in the 1002 area of Anwar. And that well was drilled under the auspices of the United States Geological Survey, mm-hmm. with the United States Fish and Wildlife Service watching and all the rest of that. When they took that well away and the gravel pad, which is about, again, 4 or 5 acre gravel pad, they took that thing away. You take pictures of that site a year after that well was capped, you would not be able to tell it existed at all. They're that good about repairing the land. And by the way, it's law. They have to. They're not allowed just to leave it there. They cannot just, you know, destroy the tundra and run away. By law, they have to repair the land to the exact state it was before they got there. That's mandated by law.
Here's what concerns me, uh-huh. and maybe you can respond to it. I know you will. Prudhoe Bay, which you mentioned, is huge, our largest oil field beyond the western edge of Anwar.
Mm-hmm.
BP, which has been a big player up there,
yep.
pleads guilty to dumping hazardous waste about almost 10 years ago, fined $22 million. Between 1997 and 1998, responsible for at least 104 oil spills in Prudhoe Bay. Now, we've seen since then, outside of Alaska, with respect to that company alone, what's happened in Texas City and other places around the world where they explore and they refine. How can American people be sure that oil companies will not despoil what many consider to be one of the last pristine environments in the world?
Right. I mean, that's a very good point. First, I'd like to say what the definition of a spill is. A spill in the Arctic is any liquid or substance whatsoever over 1 teaspoon. Now, the oil spills that you allude to, they happened, and they were cleaned up, and they were reported, and whatever damage was done was repaired. Now, you have to realize that almost 100% of these oil spills are taking place on gravel paths. You go up there with a shovel, you scoop it up, you put it in a bag, and you incinerate it. It never, ever gets on the tundra.
Adrian, I understand that, and I'm not going to quibble with you about the definition of a spill,
mm-hmm.
but I was around for Exxon Valdez. That was 1989. We're almost 20 years later, and some portions of that area still haven't been totally cleaned up by Exxon.
Mm-hmm.
So the important thing that I need to know is, as somebody who sees the need for this energy use of the Arctic, but at the same time wants to keep it as pristine as possible, is I'm not sure I can trust oil companies. Why are you so sure that people can?
Well, first of all, it's the law. If an oil company spills oil, that's against the law. It's not allowed. They are fined, and people lose their jobs
mm-hmm.
over these things. It is not in the oil company's interest, which is a profit-making interest, to be fined by anybody. It costs them money. So they do everything in their power to make sure it doesn't happen. But I'm not here to tell you it's not ever going to happen.
It's going to happen. I mean, that was my next question.
Yeah.
It's a given. It's going to happen.
Absolutely. Absolutely. The thing is, look here, you've got over 1 million miles of pipeline in the Prudhoe Bay oil field. You look at how many leaks you have in the plumbing of your house, which hardly has 1 mile of pipeline. And you think, and, you know, does anybody want to tell me that there's not going to be an oil spill or a leak somewhere along the line in over 1 million miles of pipe? There will be. There's no doubt about it. But it's what you do about that fact. That's what matters. And the fact is that the Environmental Protection Agency, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, and all the other federal agencies that monitor activity up there have rules and regulations that are totally on a daily, 24/7, 365-day-a-year basis enforced against misuse or inappropriate industrial activity.
Let me ask you one more question in conclusion of our conversation. Between now and the time, if we get to the point where we start drilling up there, can I move to Alaska, become a permanent resident of Alaska? Because I could probably rake in some serious money off of this deal, can't I?
Yeah, well, come up quickly. Yeah, it takes 6 months for you to gain residency.
And then after that, what? No income tax? No,
And you can
no sales tax?
Job.
And I'd also get a kind of like a stipend from the government on the amount of money that Alaska gets from oil, right?
A dividend check.
Oh,
yeah.
Wow.
And hopefully that keeps continuing to become.
I'm living in the wrong place.
Yeah.
Adrian Herrera, our guest on the Dave Baum Show from Arctic Power. You can look him up on the website, www.anwr.org. Adrian, thank you for your time today. We appreciate it.
Thanks, Dave.
The Dave Baum Show will continue with the other side of the issue. The issue is, do we drill for a lot of oil in the Arctic? Stick around.